atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy.
I'm political scientist Kimberly Weir, and today I'm talking with Mary Chung Hayashi, former California State Assembly member, principal of Public Policy and Advocacy Solutions, and author of Women in Politics, Breaking Down the Barriers to Achieve True Representation. Mary Chung Hayashi, welcome to the show.
Hello, Kimberly. Thank you so much for having me.
I really enjoyed reading your book, and I found it quite inspirational. And I think that once we talk about your book, people will also be inspired to read your book.
Thank you so much.
The overarching message of your book is that if a woman wants to run for office, she should focus on what she brings to the table rather than the many barriers in place. What are the benefits of having women in elected government positions, whether they're at the local, state, or federal level?
Kimberly, can I just say just very briefly that I'm just really honored to be part of your show. And I read your bio and I was also very inspired and moved because one of the things that, I mean, I talk about this in the book, just a little bit, not a lot, but one of the things that I often talk about is how when I took this class at Cal State Long Beach, it was a women's studies class. And I thought, you know, this is a book about, or this is a class about, you know, how I could be a better woman. Like, I didn't know what it was. I had no concept of, you know, the feminist theories or, you know, the women's movement. I didn't know any of that. And being an immigrant person with very conservative parents who expected me to, you know, get married and have kids, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that was sort of the expectation of me. And I took this class thinking, oh, it's like home economics. I'm going to be a better mother or a woman, you know, to my spouse. And it really changed my life, you know, and it and literally changed sort of my trajectory and my life path. And it gave me a purpose, you know, something to look forward to. And it led me to many incredible advocacy opportunities. And so I value so much like what you do every single day. You know, you probably know some, but you have no idea how many lives you touch. And I was one of those students, you know, back then, and when I was just lost, didn't speak, you know, English well. You know, I mean, I came to this country when I was 12, and this is when I was 19 when I took this class. And so by reading women literature and taking this class really changed me. And so thank you for what you do every single day. I just have to get that out there and say that.
I feel like you turned the interview around on me here and it's about me instead.
No, I mean, it's just, it's very sincere and it's in my book and it's really changed my life. So anyway, so I'm very honored to join you. And so let's talk about the book because, you know, I think what I mean by, you know, why women should think about what they bring to the table rather than what they lack is because often I think women tend to start from a place of lack, like what we don't bring to the table. And, you know, from a very young age, girls are often, you know, taught to diminish their skills and achievements. And whereas, you know, boys are taught to value, you know, certain characteristics like assertiveness, confidence, self-promotion, which is very important, by the way, in politics. And, you know, girls are raised differently. And so when we are often asked or when we are sort of confronted with this question, oh, should I run for office or should I go for this? I think we talk ourselves out of it. And so one of the things that I really hope that people could sort of take away from this book is that, you know, I bring a lot to the table. And instead of focusing on what I don't have, think about what you do have, because, you know, your journey does prepare you. And so that's what I mean by, you know, thinking about what, you know, she brings to the table. And then the second part of the question that you asked about the benefits of having, you know, women in elected government. I mean, obviously, I have a lot to say on this because I, you know, it's like a 50,000 word book. But I think women, studies have shown, and my interviews as well, women focus on issues of great importance that are often understudied by men. And so, you know, I try to reinforce this sort of point with research and the interviews that I've done. And one, obviously, I use my own, you know, experience, which is that, you know, I lost my older sister to suicide, and I spent my entire life advocating for mental health issues. But I found out that other women legislators are motivated by the same very personal, sometimes deep issues that were impacted by. And so Lauren Book, who's the Florida Senate Minority Leader, you know, she was a survivor of sexual assault for many years. And so when, you know, she was encouraged by her dad to run for office, and when she got in, she was the voice for, you know, survivors of sexual assault, and did a lot of great work in Florida. And so I try to, you know, the book is sort of, you know, both the interviews of, you know, women who are actually in politics, as well as a lot of research and good academic studies that are out there to sort of reinforce those points. And so, you know, I'll stop there because I think we could talk a lot more about, you know, how women have changed government and politics and why their involvement is essential.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to the fact that more than 50% of the population is women, and yet when we look at actual representation, it's way disproportionate in terms of male to female. And I think that that's, you know, that's one of the really important points that you really try to draw out in your book by offering the personal experiences of a lot of different women who have gotten involved in politics for different reasons, some who actually got involved and then decided, well, this is a little bit too much, but then found other ways to really sort of get at the same issues, but without necessarily holding office.
Thank you. Yes, that's exactly the point. I've interviewed women who decided to abandon their campaigns. And, you know, one of the women who was running for state assembly, she actually made the top two. Like, she won in the primary, but decided to abandon the campaign and get out, you know, and that's very rare. You know, women, I think, often make these decisions, you know, based on what is good for the collective. So they have, you know, in Gisele Hale's case, it was like her kids, you know, she wanted to protect her children. You know, and she also talked about her spouse, her husband, you know, also, you know, came from a broken family, and she really didn't want to burden her husband and children with all the negative attacks and all the stress that brought on, you know, by the campaign. So I think women candidates and legislators, you know, they sort of have a different process. They have different principles. And even when they don't, you know, even when they decide to abandon their campaigns and leave, they turn around and come back and do some amazing things, you know, like Connie Perez and others in the book. And, you know, there are just such differences just in terms of like gender gap and political ambition. And, you know, I think that, you know, men are more likely than women to have been encouraged to run for office by, you know, another elected official or party leader, whereas, you know, women are often discouraged to run. And, you know, I sort of talked about that in my race as well. But, you know, women of color, studies have shown that women of color experience more discouraging words from party leaders and elected officials than, you know, their counterparts. So there's a lot of work we need to do.
I think that there are a lot of different directions that we could go with what you just said, because there's the media, there's the mentoring or lack of mentoring, right? There's the negative publicity that a lot of women end up being subjected to, right? And the harassment just for actually running for and wanting to run for office. And so this really sort of one question that often comes up is, well, While the advantages of having more women in politics might seem obvious to most people, like me and you, right? Some have argued that demographic representation doesn't really matter. Do you think that it's the issue positions of candidates? Do you think that it's the issue positions of candidates we should care about and not their gender, with this argument of, well, it doesn't really matter what the gender of the person is?
Right, right. You know, interestingly, it's a fair question because, like, I think about, I think about who I personally support. And while I want to support all women, I'm going to support candidates who sort of, you know, share the same value system. So often, you know, voters will choose a candidate based on, like, the party affiliation. Democrats, they don't want to vote for Republicans, and Republicans don't want to vote for Democrats. So those factors, I think, are more prominent, you know, in voters' mind. But I think what we're talking about here, and people often sort of use political parity, and that's like 50-50, political parity and gender equality kind of in a different, you know, they see those two issues as not intersecting. To me, if we have gender equality, like, we wouldn't be talking about political parity, because women who have gone to Congress, for example, and before women, you know, started running for, federal positions, like, we didn't have the NIH, National Institutes of Health, for example. They weren't even doing women research on women's health. This is just one example. You know, Violence Against Women Act, Family Leave Act, reproductive rights. I mean, all of these issues are championed by women. And so women champion gender equality issues, women's issues. And this is well documented. It's not that men don't, support those issues. But it wasn't until we got women elected to these important positions that we started seeing gender equality. And so I think those two issues are sort of intertwined and related, and we can't really talk about one without the other. And, you know, it's okay to vote for a man if the man shares more of a gender equality values than the woman opponent.
I mean, and women certainly need the support of men as well.
Yes, they do. They do. And they're 50% of the population. And one man I interviewed for the book is my mentor, who actually encouraged me to run for public office. And before that, you know, nobody really put that idea in my head. So I think, I think it's important to recognize that it is okay to have male mentors, and that they should absolutely be part of the solution. And studies have shown that when men talk about gender equality, more men are likely to listen to them. I mean, that's also very, it's like important to, intuitively, like, everybody gets that. But it's important to have, allies and mentors. And almost every woman that I interviewed in my book had a male mentor
who helped. And almost out of necessity, right? Just because of the lack of women in those roles who were there to offer mentorship.
Correct. I mean, look at corporate America. I cite a study that was done by New York Times. It's like 7 or 8 years old now, but it said that there are more male CEOs named John than actual female CEOs within Fortune 500 companies. So we see that and say, well, okay, why is, parity, gender parity important there? I mean, the answer is sort of obvious, but I think sometimes it's good to sort of talk about that, and what, especially when we talk about representative democracy and our government and the way the government was set up, it's women absolutely need to be at the table. We don't have to, like, justify why we need to be at the table.
Yeah. I mean, since men have traditionally held the power both inside and outside of the home, Why is it so imperative for women to cultivate the support of men? I mean, ambitious women are often labeled as male bashers, as you were saying at the onset of our interview, that women have to represent themselves. They have to be assertive. And yet when they do these things, these exact same things that men are doing, they get the negative label attached to them.
Right. And I was recently involved in a campaign down in Los Angeles. Los Angeles elected its first female mayor last year. It's pretty incredible. We've never had a woman governor in California. And there was an event. It was called Women for Karen Bass. Like, it was organizing like feminists and the women's community for Karen Bass. At this event, another woman asked Karen this question. She said, "Why do you think you're strong enough to lead Los Angeles?" You know? And so, you know, our society values more masculine style of leadership. And I think as a result of that, women and politicians often worry about coming across as too strong, too opinionated, or taking too much credit. And these are very essential skill sets. I mean, you have to have those characteristics in order to, you know, have leadership, you know, those traditional leadership qualities. And so what happens is when a woman announces her candidacy for public office, people often view her with distrust, and her motivation for, you know, running are questioned. And we're often penalized for being ambitious and strong. And, you know, no matter what we do, it's, you know, it feels like, you know, we begin at a significant advantage. I don't know if you saw that movie Barbie, but, you know, she talks about how we're not supposed to ask for money because it's crass, but then we're supposed to be wealthy and we're supposed to be thin, but healthy, you know, you know, and those sort of conflicting messages. And sometimes it's just hard because we, you know, we're socialized to undervalue our skills. And that good, you know, I talk a lot about this good girl upbringing. You know, for me, you know, I was not encouraged to be strong or assertive or even make eye contact. My first job, real job interview, like, I didn't even ask how much money I was going to make, because that was something that we weren't supposed to do. So I had to go from that to making cold calls, mostly to men, asking for money, you know, strangers for money for my campaign. And so it's a tough transition for a lot of women. Even Dr. Jean Fuller, you know, educator, just really smart. And she has such a hard time calling people and asking for money. She's like, "What is this?" It's like, "Why do I have to do this?" And it's part of, you know, it's part of the sort of, you know, work that you have to do to win. And I think, so that's also very difficult, but it's also the societal sort of values, you know, there are more emphasis on masculine style of leadership, and it's a problem.
Not just leadership, but the double standard for men and women in the public sphere is just so unfair. How does a male candidate benefit? I mean, even when it comes to the family, when the family is brought into the campaign on the campaign trail, like, how is it in your experience that the male candidate tends to benefit from this?
Right.
Family matters.
I recently wrote an article for a magazine. It's titled Barbie for President, because Barbie was president, like, Barbie became president 25 years ago, and we're still trying. And so, you know, I think one of the things that I have never seen in all the debates, you know, for president is when, like, nobody ever asked the man, you know, who's taking care of the kids while you're campaigning. Nobody does. And, you know, voters will critique women candidates without children. So I don't have any children. But I interviewed Kathleen Galgiani, who also doesn't have children. We served together. And when she was running, her opponent said that she had no family values because she doesn't have children and she's single. She's unmarried with no kids. And So when you don't have children, voters are sort of suspicious and like, oh, does she understand, you know, what it means to be a mother? Now, if you have young children, though, the voters also critique them and say, oh, are they able to balance the task of motherhood? Are they a good mom? And can they do the job? You know, and it's a very demanding job. And can they do so? You know, I think the voters are more, they're less likely to be concerned if your kids are older. But if you're a woman with young children, they critique those women. And it's just, it's so unfair because nobody's asking the same question to the, like, oh, as a father, you know, how often are you at home? You know,
me. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There they are, like in the family pictures and showing them off as, oh, right. But the reality of it is who's actually taking care of those kids? It's either the wife who's expected to stay home and do it, or it's the hired nanny who is invariably a woman, likely of color, who's then raising the kids. But that's never something that's highlighted when a man is running for office.
One of the women that I referenced in my book, Congresswoman Grace Meng, and this happened recently, and this is where I feel like we've come a long way, but then at the same time, no, we haven't, because this happened to her recently. She took her kids, you know, to a community event on a Saturday, like at a park or something, and she took her daughter, and somebody approached her and said, I didn't vote for you so you could be a babysitter. You know, whereas when men bring their kids to political events, you know, they say, wow, what a great role model, you know, for his kids. And it's so great that he brings his kids to work. So, yes, you know, we're still experiencing this type of gender bias on the campaign trail. Yes. I did a lot of, you know, research on existing studies of, you know, sexism, gender discrimination in the workplace. And so, you know, I would pull up these articles and I'll print them out. And I was reading this article that was like, I think it was the LA Times, about, you know, gender parity and politics and this and that. And I thought, wow, this is really relevant. I need to include this information in my book. And I looked at the date and it was 1980. So then I thought, okay, wait a minute. Right. So,
but the point is it is actually relevant, right? Because even that long ago, this was an issue that was still right on, like out there saying, hey, we need to have more representation. And yet here we are, oh my gosh, so many years later, right? Still discussing these exact same issues of why women are still so underrepresented in political office.
Right.
Right. And not just, and you mentioned earlier, it's not just political office, it's women in the business world. And you tie these things together and then you end up with, well, how is it that money, how are women supposed to raise money, right? It's not like they're going to have a ton of money necessarily, certainly not usually their own. It typically comes from their family, right? As you point out in your book, because if they're trying to be a CEO, what are the chances they're going to have time to be a politician as well on the side? And so we've got the money factor as part of that discrimination. What would you say right. to that? And I mean, even in your own experience, as you talk about in the book, it's like, wow.
Well, so it just going back to the sort of the women, you know, in the corporate sector, there was a study, I think it was out of like 1,200, you know, women executives, you know, who sort of reached the top within their companies, said every single one of them said they had a male mentor, you know, and so that it's not because, you know, and of course, women who did not have a mentor had a harder time reaching those, you know, executive level positions. And I think that men, you know, play obviously an important role, but they also need to, that saying, you can't be what you can't see. And I reference that in my book throughout. And it's, you know, it's really true for women and girls, but it's also true for men as well. Like they need good examples too. And look at the way Sarah Palin was treated, or her husband was treated when she ran. I mean, people mocked him and said, oh, you're a stay-at-home dad. And it was sort of implied in a negative way. But we have
the
first female vice president, and her husband seems to be enjoying the job, and he's so supportive of her. And so I think those examples are also really important, you know, if we're going to encourage more men to do the right thing.
Well, and the really sad thing is that here is, you know, the man staying at home doing what the woman would be doing if the man was the political official. And yet he's chastised for exactly the same work, right? That just goes to show how diminished, what the sort of diminished value we have of what women's work in the household actually is.
It's really true. And just like the way women candidates have to worry about, you know, whether we're being too aggressive and too assertive or too ambitious, you know, because we're not supposed to be any of those things. You know, they also have to worry about, oh, if I have kids, you know, how am I going to explain that to the voters? You know, is it okay to run for office if I have small children? And a woman asked me that at an Emerge conference not too long ago. And I thought to myself, wow, this is still happening. You know, yeah. It's like it doesn't change. Like the numbers have improved a little bit, but the conversation seems like we're still having those conversations.
Still, yeah. And along those lines, given the statistics for financial backing for women of color, it's amazing that any woman of color has ever gotten elected to office in the United States.
Yes.
I mean, right? But why is underrepresentation? I think there are a couple of things that go along with this of why underrepresentation is particularly disadvantageous to women of color. So what do you think about that?
There's like a number of different, you know, barriers. There's, you know, I break them down to three main themes, which is the ambition gap, qualification gap, and, you know, likability, double standards. But I think we have all of those barriers, but I think for, you know, women of color, it's particularly difficult because we are not, like for Asian women, we're not really seen as leaders. Where our stereotypes are more like, oh, we're good at finance, you know, we're responsible, we're the model minority, but we're not really viewed as, you know, women who can lead companies. I mean, there's no Asian women CEO in the 100 top Fortune 500, 100 companies. And among Fortune 500, there's only 3 Asian women. So I think people use those stereotypes against us. And there's also a question of viability, because for some reason, you know, and because men have more of those rich, powerful networks, they're the gatekeepers. You know, like the political action committees tend to fund incumbents. You know, they favor incumbents. Well, who are the incumbents? Men. To this day, I think when I talk to women legislators, they often talk about they will write a smaller check to women because they're not really sure if she could win. So this viability seems to be a big factor. And I think for women of color, especially Black women and Asian women, we're just not seen as, we're not seen as winners. It's really an interesting thing. And when I decided to run, I thought I had it all figured out. You know, I had Tipper Gore's endorsement, and I thought, well, I've done all this, you know, national advocacy work. I have all this experience. And I thought I was all that. And I went to the local Democratic Party chair. She was also a woman. And I said, you know, I'm so ready for this. I want to fix healthcare. I'm passionate about mental health. And she says, well, I don't, you know, have you thought about running for something small? Like, you don't have any experience. Like, how are you going to win? And my male opponent had never ran for office either. But nobody would question him or you know, challenge him. And so I go back to sort of that qualification gap where women have to constantly prove that we're qualified to be here. And it's still happening to me today. You know, And we're not
That's
in a meeting. I don't know
seriously
about if your world, but
no. Yeah. I was gonna say, you know, anyone who, you know, people should read your book and see what your qualifications are and then question that, because my gosh, very impressive.
Yeah. So it's like, I find myself like, it happened recently at a meeting, you know, and it's like, I say something, but then it gets contradicted. And then the same man who said I was incorrect turned around and said, well, actually, Mary's right. And then he said what I say. And then I find myself saying what my qualification is, like reading my resume sometimes, because I'm like, do you remember I was a committee chair? Like, and I just really hate that. And I don't like myself when I'm like that, but that's still happening. So we have to prove that we're qualified. Now, there's a likability double standard, meaning voters will often vote for a man who they don't like, but they will not vote for a woman candidate that they do not like. So we saw that with, you know, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, where voters will often say, well, I don't like Hillary Clinton, even though she was overqualified. Donald Trump, on the other hand, was not qualified, but they would vote for the man because they like. So if it was reversed, like, that would never happen. If Donald Trump was a woman, it wouldn't happen. And so, well, so what's a likability double standard? Well, for me, because people have these Asian women stereotype biased in their head about how I should behave, I should be grateful, I should be quiet, you know, I shouldn't have an opinion. When I present myself, if my behaviors are contrary to those stereotypes, I get penalized for that. People don't like it. They don't like it. And so you have to have ambition, but not like super ambitious. You know, you have to be qualified, but you have to constantly prove that you are qualified to be here. And then you also have to be likable. You can't be too assertive or, you know, get into this headspace in voters' mind about, oh, what she should be. And so in order for women of color to win, like for Black women, you know, they have certain stereotypes. And so when they behave differently, voters, you know, wonder what that's about, and that, you know, the candidate gets penalized for that. So it's much more complex and complicated for women of color. And I, you know, I won that first race, and I ran against a white male who never ran for office either. I mean, I never ran. I mean, I thought he was qualified. I thought I was qualified, but he never got the qualification question. And furthermore, I, you know, he kept saying like I was born and raised here. Like that was kind of his opening line, meaning I wasn't, and I don't know why that's negative, but he kind of tried to use it as a negative, you know. And so, and then he also would talk about how he had all these Asian American people backing him. It's like, well, can I say I have all these white men backing
me? Like,
right?
So it would sound so absurd if you said that, right?
Right. Like if I said, oh, white men for Mary, like that's just weird. And you know, but I mean, he was the county fire chief, very well respected, you know, but I had the endorsement of the firefighters. So I would kind of use that instead of saying white men for Mary. I said, well, firefighters are backing. But it's like that, you know, that race gender thing is kind of a big deal. It's very subtle, but it does sort of play a role in, you know, in voters' mind, like, oh, well, I don't really like her. Oh, why? Oh, I don't know why.
Yeah. You know, like I think some of it too is it, you have to be successful and you have to constantly, as you were saying, read your resume, yet you can't be an overachiever because that's bad too. If you're an overachiever, then you're not raising children or you're not taking care of the household or you're aging parents or whatever it is that you should be doing.
Right. And these sort of stereotypes and expectations, you know, voters have about what Asian women candidates should be, you know, it really hurts those who are running. And so that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, we don't have as many women of color particularly Asian women in public office. It's our upbringing, you know, it's our value system, it's how we were raised. We're not supposed to be ambitious. And in fact, there's an interesting study that looked at college-aged women and men. And, you know, women say, well, I want to start a nonprofit, or I want to go work for a nonprofit organization. And the guys would say, well, men would choose politics to advocate for social change. I really wasn't interested. I mean, I went to Congress and I lobbied for various, you know, public policy issues, but it never occurred to me that I could do that, you know, until I met Daryl and I started working for him. And he suggested the idea. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Maybe I could do that. You know, and it's like, that's all it takes. It's like sometimes taking the right women's studies class. That's all it takes.
There are a few things there that I think are worth commenting on. One, a lot of people don't realize, a lot of people hear about the glass ceiling that women face. But when it comes to women of color, there's also the concrete ceiling, right? It's called the concrete ceiling because women of color have that additional barrier. And then for poorer women who tend to be also women of color, like Latina women, there's the sticky floor, or Asian women, Black women, the sticky floor, right? Because they have even a harder time because they also have that financial disadvantage built in to everything else that's working against them. So there's two sort of avenues that are worth exploring, I think, from that. One is how you talk a lot about likability and the role of the media, and how women can tackle these barriers to take ownership of the media, as you put in your book. But also you talk about, and I think this is really pertinent to what you just said, also the imagination barrier, which you also talk about in your book, and how this has an impact on women in politics. So could you talk about, I know it's hard because all these things go together, right?
It does.
I don't mean to dump a bunch on you at once, but.
And you know, political scientists, you know, have given this a name, imagination barrier. And what it is, you know, and I interviewed Barbara Lee Family Foundation Executive Director Amanda Hunter, who did this study where they asked the focus group participants to, you know, vision a governor. And the overwhelming participants envisioned a man. And so, you know, the political science gave this, you know, that is the imagination barrier. We can't imagine somebody else doing that job. And so how do we sort of reimagine, you know, and that is possible when women run for office and win, and women of color overcoming incredible odds to win. And so going back to Karen Bass's campaign, her opponent was a billionaire, was a developer, and he wrote $108 million to the campaign from his personal checking account. No, I'm kidding. I don't know if it's checking account or a savings account, but he spent over $100 million. And so think about the time he like saves, you know, like not having to do fundraisers and make calls. And so he just kept writing the checks. Well, on the other hand, Karen, you know, raised $9 million. That includes primary and, you know, general. And people say to me, well, that's a lot still, you know, 9 million is a lot. And it is. And most of the donations were small, like average $100. So it was a really a national campaign because she ran against such a wealthy person, and she beat him by 7 points. Yeah. And so what do we learn from that? Well, money is important in politics, but it's not everything. And it's certainly not the deciding factor. And so I often tell women, you know, you just need enough to win, not the most. So it's important to remember that. And we all have to start with our families and friends, people who are closest to us. And then, you know, and then you can sort of build up on that. And what's really disturbing about, you know, media coverage of women politicians, and studies have shown that when press talks about woman candidate, whether it's positive or negative, voters do not like her. Like your likability plummets when the press talks about you. And it's especially if they talk about what you look like. And so, and I don't know why that's important, because I've never seen like press talk about what Bernie Sanders looked like, for instance, you know? So it's just interesting that they feel the need to do that. But what's happened with social media, whether you're, you know, for it or against, that has really given women candidates sort of leveled the playing field, because social media is relatively cheap and you can reach a lot of people. So, you know, when I ran, there was no social media. So everything was like, you had to call people like manually from like a plastic phone. And then you also have to mail things through the post office. I mean, think about the postage and how much money you need to send one mailer, you know, and you would, California districts are big. So it's, you know, 500,000 people you have to reach. And so when you get attacked, by the time you design the mailer and respond and mail, it's like 2 weeks later. Well, it's not like that anymore. Campaigns are very just sophisticated, you know, and you can reach a lot of people if you have a good social media program. And so that's what I mean. Like, that's one example of how women can kind of take control of their own messaging. Of course, you know, Facebook did a big study that showed that Democratic women were 10 times more likely than men to get trashed and attacked. So it isn't the sort of the, you know, kindest place, but you can control your messaging and you can reach people quickly and you can reach a lot of people without having those resources. And that's sort of one example. You know, Nikki Haley, who I don't align with at all politically, but I just love that, you know, she has done a great job of just kind of taking on the press and addressing and calling people out, because one of her opponents said, you know, Nikki Haley is Dick Cheney on high heels. I mean, that's a very sexist thing to say. And she called them out on that. And she responded that so quickly. And so that's another example. And those are the types of things that I think women candidates can do, which really wasn't available to me when I was running like the first time. Yeah, think about that. You have to call people.
I think that one of the things that you mentioned that's important is finding ways that women can get support. So in one of the things you mentioned in your book is that women have created organizations like Emerge America and Emily's List, which, for those who are unfamiliar with the group, is an acronym for Early Money is Like Yeast because it makes dough rise. These are things that help women, and resources that women who are interested in politics might not be familiar with. So what would you say are the ways that these organizations can help them?
Well, yeah. And this is, again, this is another thing that didn't exist. Like, Emerge America was founded, I think, around the same time when I was, you know, thinking about running, or when I was actually running for office. And now they, you know, train you, and they give you these tools, like how to pull together a campaign, you know, how to do social media, how to respond to the press. And I just think it's so amazing that everybody should take advantage of. And, you know, Emily's List, you know, started in the 80s, I think 90s, to help elect more women to the U.S. Senate. I think that was their original sort of mission. And they've really expanded to supporting more local races because they realize, well, their women have to come from somewhere. They're not going to wake up in one morning and look at themselves in the mirror and say, I'm going to run for president or U.S. Senate. They're going to probably start at the local school level, city council, state legislature. So they started really broadening their, you know, services and training opportunities and funding. And I just think that it's amazing. Those things weren't really like readily available to me when I ran. And, you know, they both of those organizations have experienced in recent years just incredible amount of applications from women. In fact, after Donald Trump's campaign, I think it increased by like threefold or something. They just couldn't process all the interest in applications and get everybody. Before that, they had to go out and find people to apply for the program. And so, you know, a lot of political scientists talked about the Donald Trump effect. Well, I actually like to credit Hillary Clinton as well, because, again, going back to sort of the imagination barrier and how to remove that barrier, reimagine Hillary Clinton running for the highest office in the nation shows other women that it's possible. Okay, she didn't win, but what happened? Following her, there were a number of other women running for president. You know, Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren. So it does help lift other women up because they see that it's possible and they could do it too.
I think that something important to point out from your book is the fact that you encourage women across the board, right? You talk about Sarah Palin, how she also was an inspiration for young Republican women. And it doesn't matter. I mean, you move beyond your personal affiliation, your personal biases, and what your alignment is. And you say, women, it doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, independent, whatever. You know, you're very fair in your book in saying you should participate if that is what you think you should do, right? Or maybe even if you don't think you should, especially if you don't think you should do it, right? Because we need more women in politics, bottom line.
Yeah, and some of the Republican younger women, you know, Republican women in Congress are really struggling with that, with some of the older Republican women within their party. And, you know, Elise Stefanik, I mean, regardless of how you feel about her, you know, on the night of the election, she said, you know, she was really proud to, you know, break that glass ceiling, you know, and she recruited over 100 Republican women to run for office. And so while I don't agree with her on policies, you know, she understands the importance of, you know, women being at the table. I mean, it's kind of like Ruth Bader Ginsburg said it. I mean, women belongs in all the places where decisions are made. And so, yeah, so regardless of, you know, party affiliation, I really think it takes courage for her to take on some of those establishments, you know, more established legislators within the Republican Party. I think it's amazing.
They're already conservative as it is. And then they maybe feel like, well, I had to do this to get here. And, you know, like I really earned this position and you didn't quite earn the position that I did, you know, and the old guard still part of, as you were talking about earlier, so that old boys club, except, you know, that woman who's like Margaret Thatcher, who was the woman in the iron skirt, you know,
right.
The iron woman in the skirt, right? Like that sort of same mentality is still there built in. And it goes back to what you were saying about imagination. And imagining like those norms that we all expect, how you were saying people get uncomfortable if you don't act like you're supposed to be based on what you look like, what people perceive you should act like. And we all feel a little off kilter, right? We're a little like uncomfortable when somebody doesn't fit into that mold that we have those preconceived notions about.
Yes. Well, see, you're a teacher. So you're like summarizing it really well and just bringing everything together. That's exactly it.
Yeah. And so because we're close to the end, I have one more question I wanted to ask you. And well, I had a lot more questions, but we'll have to settle with just this one. Public participation requires women to challenge so many political, economic, social norms, as we were just talking about, breaking out of the good girl habits that you describe to adapt strong girl habits. I like that you turned this around for yourself. So taking everything into consideration that you've mentioned and that you've, you know, what you've written about in your book, basically, I would sum up your book as a handbook for how women can succeed in politics, seriously. And so what would you say are the two or three most important pieces of advice that you would give to not just women, but particularly young women?
Well, thank you, Kimberly. And I really enjoyed this. And I really appreciate the opportunity. On Saturday, I spoke to high school girls, 15, I think they were 15 to 17, and they were women of color. They called themselves women of color students for social change. I think they were just so amazing. And I always learned so much from, you know, young women. And they asked me the same question. You know, it's like, well, what's the advice? Like, give me one takeaway from this. And I did a little reading from the book where I interviewed LaFonza Butler, who is our U.S. senator now. She was the president of the Emily's List. And I interviewed her and asked her the same question, just because they're in the business of training a lot of young women. And I agree with her comments. And this is advice that I would give to people, is that, you know, do it anyway. You know, despite those doubts you have or the concerns or whether you think you're qualified or not. When I was 26 years old, I started a national nonprofit organization focused on Asian American women's health issues. And, you know, and change the way our federal government collects data on Asian Americans. Because before that, we weren't really counted. And unless we had those data collection, you know, unless we were included in the data collection, we weren't getting the support that we needed in federal, like prevention, public health money. And so it was such an important lesson. And I was so glad that I had done that work. And I raised over $10 million when I was running that organization. And I didn't know anything. I really had a lot to learn, but I had incredible support, mentors, and people who were willing to help me. So I was really glad I just did it anyway. And a lot of people discouraged me as well. I put that in my book. You know, my former director was like, you're not ready for this. You don't know anything, you know, but I did it anyway. And it was amazing. Same thing with my, you know, assembly race. I got a lot of discouragement because people thought I wasn't ready. I wasn't qualified. I was not likable enough, whatever the reason was, you know, but I did it anyway. And I won. And I, you know, I passed the legislation that created statewide office of suicide prevention, you know, for 40 million people. And so I'm so glad I just did it anyway, despite those, you know, discouragement, I got, you know, advice I got. So that's my advice to people, is that don't start from a place of lack, because you have so much to give and so much to bring to the table. And so even when you have doubts, I really encourage you to take the chance and do it anyway.
Yeah, I think that ignorance is bliss, right? Because you not knowing what an uphill battle it was going to be, and not, I mean, you sold yourself short, because you didn't just get the funding for the surveying just for the CDC. I mean, this was all public funding for Asian Americans to actually be included in surveys in ways they hadn't been before.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's huge. And had you even imagined that when you started, you know, your charity, nonprofit organization, that this is where you would have ended up? And so it's not, you know, having that imagination and going outside of the box to say, hey, you know, like, I'm going to try. What's the worst that can happen? I fail, right?
Right, right. And I, you know, I failed too. I mean, I lost campaigns too, and it doesn't feel good, but you know, it shouldn't prevent you from pursuing your passion.
And you've gone on to do so many other things that are really important anyway. So these experiences just set you up for the next thing that you're meant to do, I think.
Yes. For now, it's just promoting the book.
Well, thank you very much with that. We'll close. Thank you so much, Mary. I really enjoyed talking to you. You are amazing and inspirational, and I encourage everyone to buy your book and see what they can do to change the world.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you're not already a supporter of the show, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without our supporters, we wouldn't be able to do this. And when you become a supporter, you get not just that warm, fuzzy feeling, knowing that you're supporting a good cause. I like to think we're a good cause. But you also get stuff like ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter-exclusive midweek show, the full length of that, not just the preview. And you also get to be part of our Discord group if you want. And there's always some interesting conversations going on there. At the $10 a month level or more, you get to actually be part of the episodes Jay and I do, if that's something you're interested in. So there's a lot of stuff is what I am saying, and I hope you'll consider checking it out. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at politicsguys. You can also support the show through PayPal, and all of our support links are always in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And as always, I want to close with a very special thank you to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby.